6. With his lone memory of a lone peak to embody the word mountain, Falk had imagined that as soon as they reached the mountains, they would have reached Estach. He had not realized they would have to clamber over the roof tree of a continent. Range behind range, the mountains rose. Day after day, the two crept upward into the world of the heights, and still their goal lay farther up and farther on to the southwest. Among the forests and torrents and the cloud-conversant slopes of snow and granite, there was every now and then a little camp or village along the way. Often they could not avoid these, as there was but one path to take. They rode past on their mules, the prince's princely gift at their going, and were not hindered. Estrel said that the mountain people, living here on the doorstep of the Shing, were a wary lot, who would neither molest nor welcome a stranger, and were best left alone. Camping was a cold business in April in the mountains, and the once they stopped at a village was a welcome relief. It was a tiny place, 4 wooden houses by a noisy stream in a canyon shadowed by great storm-wreathed peaks. But it had a name, Besdio. And Estrel had stayed there once years ago, she told him, when she had been a girl. The people of Besdio, a couple of whom were light-skinned and tawny-haired like Estrel herself, spoke with her briefly. They talked in the language which the wanderers used. Falk had always spoken Galactica with Estrel and had not learned this Western tongue. Estrel explained, pointing east and west. The mountain people nodded coolly, studying Estrel carefully, glancing at Falk only out of the corner of their eyes. They asked few questions, and gave food and a night's shelter ungrudgingly but with a cool, incurious manner that made Falk vaguely uneasy. The cowshed where they were to sleep was warm, however, with the live heat of the cattle and goats and poultry crowded there in sighing, odorous, peaceable companionship. While Estrel talked a little longer with their hosts in the main hut, Falk betook himself to the cowshed and made himself at home. In the hayloft above the stalls he made a luxurious double bed of hay and spread their bedrolls on it. When Estrel came he was already half asleep, but he roused himself enough to remark, "I'm glad you came. I smell something kept hidden here, but I don't know what. It's not all I smell." This was as close as Estrel had ever come to making a joke, and Falk looked at her with a bit of surprise. "You are happy to be getting close to the city, aren't you?" he asked. "I wish I were." "Why shouldn't I be? There I hope to find my kinsfolk. If I do not, the lords will help me, and there you will find what you seek, too, and be restored into your heritage."
"My heritage?
I thought you thought me a raise."
"You? Never.
Surely you don't believe, Falk, that it was the Shing that meddled with your mind?
You said that once down on the plains, and I did not understand you then. How could you think yourself a raise, or any common man? You are not earth-born."
Seldom had she spoken so positively. What she said heartened him, concurring with his own hope. But her saying it puzzled him a little, for she had been silent and troubled for a long time now. Then he saw something swing from a leather cord around her neck.
"They gave you an amulet."
That was the source of her hopefulness.
"Yes," she said,
looking down at the pendant with satisfaction.
"We are of the same faith. Now all will go well for us."
He smiled a little at her superstition, but was glad it gave her comfort. As he went to sleep, he knew she was awake, lying, looking into the darkness, full of the stink and the gentle breath and presence of the animals. When the cock crowed before daylight, he half roused and heard her whispering prayers to her amulet in the tongue he did not know. They went on, taking a path that wound south of the stormy peaks. One great mountain bulwark remained to cross, and for 4 days they climbed, till the air grew thin and icy, the sky dark blue, and the sun of April shone dazzling on the fleecy backs of clouds that grazed the meadows far beneath their way. Then, the summit of the pass attained, the sky darkened, and snow fell on the naked rocks and blanked out the great bare slopes of red and gray. There was a hut for wayfarers in the pass, and they and their mules huddled in it till the snow stopped and they could begin the descent.
"Now the way is easy," Estrelle said, turning to look at Falk over her mule's jogging rump and his mule's nodding ears. And he smiled, but there was a dread in him that only grew as they went on and down towards Es-Totch. Closer and closer they came, and the path widened into a road. They saw huts, farms, houses. They saw few people, for it was cold and rainy, keeping people indoors under a roof. The two wayfarers jogged on down the lonely road through the rain. The third morning from the summit dawned bright, and after they had ridden a couple of hours, Falk halted his mule, looking questioningly at Estrelle.
"What is it, Falk?"
"We have come. This is Es-Totch, isn't it?" The land had leveled out all about them, though distant peaks closed the horizon all around, and the pastures and ploughlands they had been riding through had given way to houses, houses and still more houses. There were huts, cabins, shanties, tenements, inns, shops where goods were made and bartered for, children everywhere, people on the highway, people on side roads, people afoot on horses and mules and sliders, coming and going. It was crowded, yet scanty, slack and busy, dirty, dreary, and vivid under the bright, dark sky of morning in the mountains.
"It is a mile or more yet to Es-Totch."
"Then, what is this city?"
"This is the outskirts of the city."
Falk stared about him, dismayed and excited. The road he had followed so far from the house in the eastern forest had become a street, leading only too quickly to its end. As they sat their mules in the middle of the street, people glanced at them, but none stayed and none spoke. The women kept their faces averted. Only some of the ragged children stared or pointed shouting and then ran, vanishing up a filth-encumbered alley or behind a shack. It was not what Falk had expected, yet what had he expected?
"I did not know there were so many people in the world," he said at last. "They swarm about the Shing like flies on dung."
"Fly maggots flourish in dung," Estrelle said dryly. Then, glancing at him, she reached across and put her hand lightly on his.
"These are the outcasts and the hangers-on, the rabble outside the walls. Let us go on to the city, the true city. We have come a long way to see it."
They rode on, and soon they saw, jutting up over the shanty roofs, the walls of windowless green towers, bright in the sunlight. Falk's heart beat hard, and he noticed that Estrelle spoke a moment to the amulet she had been given in Besdeo.
"We cannot ride the mules inside the city," she said. "We can leave them here."
They stopped at a ramshackle public stable. Estrelle talked persuasively a while in the Western tongue with the man who kept the place, and when Falk asked what she had been asking him, she said,
"To keep our mules as surety."
"Surety?"
"If we don't pay for their keep, he will keep them. You have no money, have you?"
"No," Falk said humbly. Not only did he have no money, he had never seen money, and though Galactica had a word for the thing, his forest dialect did not. The stable was the last building on the edge of a field of rubble and refuse which separated the shantytown from a high, long wall of granite blocks. There was one entrance to Es-Totch for people on foot. Great conical pillars marked the gate. On the left-hand pillar, an inscription in Galactica was carved, "Reverence for Life." On the right was a longer sentence in characters Falk had never seen. There was no traffic through the gate, and no guard. "The pillar of the lie and the pillar of the secret," he said aloud as he walked between them, refusing to let himself be overawed. But then he entered Estach, and saw it, and stood still, saying nothing. The city of the Lords of Earth was built on the two rims of a canyon, a tremendous cleft through the mountains, narrow, fantastic, its black walls striped with green, plunging terrifically down half a mile to the silver tinsel strip of a river in the shadowy depths. On the very edges of the facing cliffs, the towers of the city jutted up, hardly based on earth at all, linked across the chasm by delicate bridge spans. Towers, roadways, and bridges ceased, and the wall closed the city off again just before a vertiginous bend of the canyon. Helicopters with diaphanous vanes skimmed the abyss. The sliders flickered along the half-glimpsed streets and slender bridges. The sun, still not far above the massive peaks to eastward, seemed scarcely to cast shadows here. The great green towers shone as if translucent to the light.
"Come,"
Estrel said, a pace ahead of him, her eyes shining.
"There's nothing to fear here, Falk."
He followed her. There was no one on the street, which descended between lower buildings toward the cliff-edge towers. Once he glanced back at the gate, but he could no longer see the opening between the pillars. "Where do we go?"
"There's a place I know, a house where my people come."
She took his arm, the first time she had ever done so in all the way they had walked together, and clinging to him kept her eyes lowered as they came down the long zigzag street. Now, to their right, the buildings loomed up high as they neared the city's heart, and to the left, without wall or parapet, the dizzy gorge dropped away, full of shadows, a black gap between the luminous perching towers.
"But if we need money here, they'll look after us."
People, brightly and strangely dressed, passed them on sliders. The landing ledges high up the sheer-walled buildings flickered with helicopters. High over the gorge, an air car droned, going up.
"Are these all Xing?"
"Some."
Unconsciously, he was keeping his free hand on his laser. Estrel, without looking at him but smiling a little, said,
"Do not use your light gun here, Falk. You came here to gain your memory, not to lose it."
"Where are we going, Estrel?"
"Here."
"This? This is a palace." The luminous greenish wall towered up windowless, featureless, into the sky. Before them a square doorway stood open.
"They know me here. Don't be afraid. Come on with me."
She clung to his arm. He hesitated. Looking back up the street, he saw several men, the first he had seen on foot, loitering towards them, watching them. That scared him. And with Estrel, he entered the building, passing through inner automatic portals that slid apart at their approach. Just inside, possessed by a sense of misjudgment, having made a hideous error, he stopped. "What is this place?"
"Estrel,
it was a high hall, full of a thick greenish light, dim as an underwater cave. There were doorways and corridors, down which men approached, hurrying towards him. Estrel had broken away from him. In panic, he turned to the doors behind him. They were shut now. They had no handles. Dim figures of men broke into the hall, running at him and shouting. He backed up against the shut doors and reached for his laser. It was gone. It was in Estrel's hands. She stood behind the men as they surrounded Falk, and as he tried to break through them and was seized and fought and was beaten, he heard for a moment a sound he had never heard before. Her laugh.
A disagreeable sound rang in Falk's ears. A metallic taste filled his mouth. His head swam when he raised it, and his eyes would not focus, and he could not seem to move freely. Presently he realized that he was waking from unconsciousness, and thought he could not move because he had been hurt or drugged. Then he made out that his wrists were shackled together on a short chain, his ankles likewise. But the swimming in his head grew worse. There was a great voice booming in his ears now, repeating the same thing over and over, "Ramaran, Ramaran, Ramaran." He struggled and cried out, trying to get away from the booming voice which filled him with terror. Lights flashed in his eyes, and through the sound roaring in his head he heard someone scream in his own voice, "I am not!" When he came to again, everything was utterly still. His head ached, and still he could not see very clearly, but there were no shackles on his arms and legs now, if there ever had been any, and he knew he was being protected, sheltered, looked after. They knew who he was, and he was welcome. His own people were coming for him. He was safe here, cherished, beloved, and all he need do now was rest and sleep. Rest and sleep while the soft, deep stillness murmured tenderly in his head, "Maran, Maran, Maran." He woke. It took a while, but he woke, and managed to sit up. He had to bury his acutely aching head in his arms for a while to get over the vertigo the movement caused, and at first was aware only that he was sitting on the floor of some room. A floor which seemed to be warm and yielding, almost soft, like the flank of some great beast. Then he lifted his head and got his eyes into focus and looked about him. He was alone, in the midst of a room so uncanny that it revived his dizziness for a while. There was no furniture. Walls, floor, and ceiling were all of the same translucent stuff, which appeared soft and undulant, like many thicknesses of pale green veiling, but was tough and slick to the touch. Queer carvings and crimpings and ridges, forming ornate patterns all over the floor, were, to the exploring hand, non-existent. They were eye-deceiving paintings, or lay beneath a smooth, transparent surface. The angles where walls met were thrown out of true by optical illusion devices of cross-hatching and pseudo-parallels used as decoration. To pull the corners into right angles took an effort of will, which was perhaps an effort of self-deception, since they might, after all, not be right angles. But none of this teasing subtlety of decoration so disoriented Falk as the fact that the entire room was translucent. Vaguely, with the effect of looking into a depth of very green pond water, underneath him another room was visible. Overhead was a patch of light that might be the moon, blurred and greened by one or more intervening ceilings. Through one wall of the room, strings and patches of brightness were fairly distinct, and he could make out the motion of the lights of helicopters or air cars. Through the other three walls, these outdoor lights were much dimmer, blurred by the veilings of further walls, corridors, rooms. Shapes moved in those other rooms. He could see them, but there was no identifying them. Features, dress, color, size, all was blurred away. A blot of shadow somewhere in the green depths suddenly rose and grew less, greener, dimmer, fading into the maze of vagueness. Visibility without discrimination, solitude without privacy. It was extraordinarily beautiful, this masked shimmer of lights and shapes through inchoate planes of green, and extraordinarily disturbing. All at once, in a brighter patch on the near wall, Falk caught a glimpse of movement. He turned quickly, and with a shock of fear saw something at last vivid, distinct, a face, a seamed, savage, staring face set with two inhuman yellow eyes. "A shing," he whispered in blank dread. The face mocked him, the terrible lips mouthing soundlessly,
a shing, and he saw that it was the reflection of his own face. He got up stiffly and went to the mirror, and passed his hand over it to make sure it was a mirror, half concealed by a molded frame painted to appear flatter than it actually was. He turned from it at the sound of a voice. Across the room from him, not too clear in the dim, even light from hidden sources, but solid enough, a figure stood. There was no doorway visible, but a man had entered, and stood looking at him. A very tall man, a white cape or cloak dropping from wide shoulders, white hair, clear, dark, penetrating eyes. The man spoke. His voice was deep and very gentle. "You are welcome here, Falk. We have long awaited you, long guided and guarded you." The light was growing brighter in the room, a clear, swelling radiance. The deep voice held a note of exaltation. "Put away fear and be welcome among us, O messenger. The dark road is behind you, and your feet are set upon the way that leads you home." The brilliance grew till it dazzled Falk's eyes. He had to blink and blink again, and when he looked up, squinting, the man was gone. There came, unbidden into his mind, words spoken months ago by an old man in the forest. The awful darkness of the bright lights of Estotch. He would not be played with, drugged, deluded any longer. A fool he had been to come here, and he would never get away alive. But he would not be played with. He started forward to find the hidden doorway to follow the man. A voice from the mirror said, "Wait a moment more, Falk. Illusions are not always lies. You seek truth." A seam in the wall split and opened into a door. Two figures entered. One, slight and small, strode in. He wore breeches fitted with an ostentatious codpiece, a jerkin, a close-fitting cap. The second, taller, was heavily robed and moved mincingly, posing like a dancer. Long, purplish-black hair streamed down to her waist. His waist, it must be, for the voice, though very soft, was deep. "We are being filmed, you know, Strella."
"I know," said the little man in Estrella's voice.
Neither of them so much as glanced at Falk. They behaved as if they were alone.
"Go on with what you were about to say, Craggy."
"I was about to ask you why it took you so long."
"So long? You are unjust, my lord. How could I track him in the forest east of Shorg? It is utter wilderness. The stupid animals were no help. All they do these days is babble the law. When you finally dropped me the manfinder, I was 200 miles north of him. When I finally caught up, he was heading straight into Basnatska territory. You know the council has them furnished with bomb birds and such, so that they can thin out the wanderers and the Solia Pachim. So I had to join the filthy tribe. Have you not heard my reports? I sent them in all along, till I lost my sender crossing a river south of Kansas Enclave. And my mother in Bestio gave me another. Surely they kept my reports on tape."
"I never listened to reports." "In any case, it was all time and risk wasted, since you did not in all these weeks succeed in teaching him not to fear us."
"Estrell," Falk said. "Estrell."
Grotesque and frail in her transvestite clothes, Estrell did not turn, did not hear. She went on speaking to the robed man. Choked with shame and anger, Falk shouted her name, then strode forward and seized her shoulder, and there was nothing there. A blur of lights in the air, a flicker of color, fading. The door slit in the wall still stood open, and through it Falk could see into the next room. There stood the robed man and Estrell, their backs to him. He said her name in a whisper, and she turned and looked at him. She looked into his eyes without triumph and without shame, calmly, passively,
detached and uncaring, as she had looked at him all along.
Why did you lie to me? He said. Why did you bring me here?
He knew why. He knew what he was and always had been in Estrella's eyes. It was not his intelligence that spoke, but his self-respect and his loyalty, which could not endure or admit the truth in this first moment.
I was sent to bring you here.
You wanted to come here.
He tried to pull himself together. Standing rigid, not moving towards her, he asked,
Are you a Xing?
I am, said the robed man, affably smiling. I am a Xing. All Xing are liars. Am I then a Xing lying to you? In which case, of course, I am not a Xing, but a non-Xing lying. Or is it a lie that all Xing lie? But I am a Xing, truly, and truly I lie. Terrans and other animals have been known to tell lies also. Lizards change color. Bugs mimic sticks, and flounders lie by lying still, looking pebbly or sandy, depending on the bottom which underlies them. Strella, this one is even stupider than the child. No, my Lord Craggy. He is very intelligent, Estrella replied in her soft, passive way. She spoke of Falk as a human being speaks of an animal. She had walked beside Falk, eaten with him, slept with him. She had slept in his arms. Falk stood watching her, silent. And she and the tall one also stood silent, unmoving, as if awaiting a signal from him to go on with their performance. He could not feel rancor towards her. He felt nothing towards her. She had turned to air, to a blur and flicker of light. His feeling was all towards himself. He was sick, physically sick with humiliation. Go alone, Opalstone, said the Prince of Kansas. Go alone, said Hjardan, the beekeeper. Go alone, said the old listener in the forest. Go alone, my son, said Zove. How many others would have guided him aright, helped him on his quest, armed him with knowledge, if he had come across the prairies alone? How much might he have learned if he had not trusted Estrella's guidance and good faith? Now he knew nothing, except that he had been measurelessly stupid and that she had lied. She had lied to him from the start, steadily, from the moment she told him she was a wanderer. No, from before that, from the moment she had first seen him and had pretended not to know who or what he was. She had known all along and had been sent to make sure he got to Estach, and to counteract, perhaps, the influence those who hated the Xing had had and might have upon his mind. But then why, he thought painfully, standing there in one room, gazing at her in another, why had she stopped lying now? It does not matter what I say to you now, she said, as if she had read his thoughts.
Possibly she had. They had never used mind speech. But if she was a Xing and had the mental powers of the Xing, the extent of which was only a matter of rumor and speculation among men, she might have been attuned to his thoughts all along, all the weeks of their traveling. How could he tell? There was no use asking her. There was a sound behind him. He turned and saw two people standing at the other end of the room, near the mirror. They wore black gowns and white hoods, and were twice the height of ordinary men.
You are too easily fooled, said one giant. You must know you have been fooled, said the other. You are half a man only. Half a man cannot know the whole truth. He who hates is mocked and fooled. He who kills is raised and tooled. Where do you come from, Falk? What are you, Falk? Where are you, Falk? Who are you, Falk?
Both giants raised their hoods, showing that there was nothing inside but shadow, and backed into the wall and through it, and vanished.
Estrelle ran to him from the other room, flung her arms about him, pressing herself against him, kissing him hungrily, desperately.
"I love you. I have loved you since I first saw you. Trust me, Falk, trust me."
Then she was torn from him, wailing, "Trust me!" and was drawn away as if pulled by some mighty invisible force, as if blown by a great wind, whirled about, blown through a slit doorway that closed silently behind her, like a mouth closing.
"You realize," said the tall male in the other room, "that you are under the influence of hallucinatory drugs?" His whispering, precise voice held an undertone of sarcasm and ennui. "Trust yourself least of all, eh?" He then lifted his long robes and urinated copiously, after which he wandered out, rearranging his robes and smoothing his long, flowing hair. Falk stood watching the greenish floor of the other room gradually absorb the urine till it was quite gone. The sides of the door were very slowly drawing together, closing the slit. It was the only way out of the room in which he was trapped. He broke from his lethargy and ran through the slit before it shut. The room in which Estrelle and the other one had stood was exactly the same as the one he had left, perhaps a trifle smaller and dimmer. A slit door stood open in its far wall, but was closing very slowly. He hurried across the room and through it, and into a third room, which was exactly like the others, perhaps a trifle smaller and dimmer. The slit in its far wall was closing very slowly, and he hurried through it into another room, smaller and dimmer than the last, and from it squeezed through into another small, dim room, and from it crawled into a small, dim mirror, and fell upwards, screaming in sick terror towards the white, seamed, staring moon. He woke, feeling rested, vigorous, and confused, in a comfortable bed in a bright, windowless room. He sat up, and as if that had given a signal, two men came hurrying from behind a partition, big men with a staring, bovine look to them. "Greetings, Lord Agad, greetings, Lord Agad," they said one after the other, and then, "Come with us, please, come with us, please." Falk stood up, stark naked, ready to fight. The only thing clear in his mind at the moment was his fight and defeat in the entrance hall of the palace. But they offered no violence. "Come on, please," they repeated antiphonally, until he came with them. They led him, still naked, out of the room, up a long blank corridor, through a mirror-walled hall, up a staircase that turned out to be a ramp painted to look like stairs, through another corridor and up more ramps, and finally into a spacious, furnished room with bluish-green walls, one of which was glowing with sunlight. One of the men stopped outside the room. The other entered with Falk. "There's clothes, there's food, there's drink. Now you eat, drink. Now you ask for need. All right?" He stared persistently, but without any particular interest, at Falk. There was a pitcher of water on the table, and the first thing Falk did was drink his fill, for he was very thirsty. He looked around the strange, pleasant room, with its furniture of heavy, glass-clear plastic and its windowless, translucent walls, and then studied his guard, or attendant, with curiosity. A big, blank-faced man, with a gun strapped to his belt. "What is the law?" he asked on impulse. Obediently and with no surprise, the big, staring fellow answered, "Do not take life."
"But you carry a gun."
"Oh, this gun, it makes you all stiff, not dead," said the guard, and laughed. The modulations of his voice were arbitrary, not connected with the meaning of the words, and there was a slight pause between the words and the laugh. "Now you eat, drink, get clean. Here's good clothes. See, here's clothes."
"Are you a raise?"
"No, I am a captain of the bodyguard of the True Lords, and I key in to the number 8 computer. Now you eat, drink, get clean."
I will if you leave the room.
A slight pause.
Oh, yes, very well, Lord Agad, said the big man, and again laughed as if he had been tickled. Perhaps it tickled when the computer spoke through his brain. He withdrew.
Falk could see the vague, hulking shapes of the two guards through the inner wall of the room. They waited, one on either side of the door in the corridor. He found the washroom and washed up. Clean clothes were laid out on the great soft bed that filled one end of the room. They were loose, long robes patterned wildly with red, magenta, and violet, and he examined them with distaste, but put them on. His battered backpack lay on the table of gold-mounted, glassy plastic, its contents seemingly untouched, but his clothes and guns were not in evidence. A meal was laid out, and he was hungry. How long had it been since he had entered the doors that closed behind him? He had no idea, but his hunger told him it had been some while, and he fell too. The food was queer stuff, highly flavored, mixed, sauced, and disguised, but he ate it all and looked for more. There being no more, and since he had done what he had been asked to do, he examined the room more carefully. He could not see the vague shadows of the guards on the other side of the semi-transparent, bluish-green wall any longer, and was going to investigate when he stopped short. The barely visible vertical slit of the door was widening, and a shadow moved behind it. It opened to a tall oval through which a person stepped into the room. A girl, Falk thought at first, then saw it was a boy of 16 or so, dressed in loose robes like those he wore himself. The boy did not come close to Falk, but stopped, holding out his hands, palm upwards, and spouted a whole rush of gibberish.
Who are you?
Ori, said the young man. Ori!
And more gibberish. He looked frail and excited. His voice shook with emotion. Then he dropped down on both knees and bowed his head low, a bodily gesture that Falk had never seen, though its meaning was unmistakable. It was the full and original gesture of which, among the beekeepers and the subjects of the Prince of Kansas, he had seen certain vestigial remnants.
"Speak in Galactica," Falk said fiercely, shocked and uneasy. "Who are you?"
"I am Har Ori Prech Ramaran," the boy whispered.
"Get up. Get off your knees. I don't... Do you know me?"
"Prech Ramaran, do you not remember me? I am Ori, Harwaden's son."
"What is my name?"
The boy raised his head and Falk stared at him, at his eyes, which looked straight into his own. They were of a gray-amber color, except for the large dark pupil. All iris, without visible white, like the eyes of a cat or a stag, like no eyes Falk had ever seen, except in the mirror last night.
"Your name is Agad Ramaran," the boy said, frightened and subdued.
"How do you know it?"
I have always known it, Prech Ramaran."
"Are you of my race? Are we of the same people?"
"I am Harwaden's son, Prech Ramaran. I swear to you, I am."
There were tears in the gray-gold eyes for a moment. Falk himself had always tended to react to stress with a brief blinding of tears. Buckeye had once reproved him for being embarrassed by this trait, saying it appeared to be a purely physiological reaction, probably racial. The confusion, bewilderment, disorientation Falk had undergone since he had entered S-Touch now left him unequipped to question and judge this latest apparition. Part of his mind said, "That is exactly what they want. They want you confused to the point of total credulity." At this point he did not know whether Estrel, whom he knew so well and loved so loyally, was a friend or a Shing or a tool of the Shing, whether she had ever told him the truth or ever lied to him, whether she had been trapped here with him or had lured him here into a trap. He remembered a laugh. He also remembered a desperate embrace, a whisper.
What then was he to make of this boy looking at him in awe and pain with unearthly eyes like his own? Would he turn, if touched, to a blur of lights? Would he answer questions with lies or truth? Amidst all illusions, errors, and deceptions, there remained, it seemed to Falk, only one way to take, the way he had followed all along, from Zove's house on. He looked at the boy again and told him the truth. I do not know you. If I should remember you, I do not, because I remember nothing longer ago than 4 or 5 years. He cleared his throat, turned away again, sat down on one of the tall, spindly chairs, motioned for the boy to do the same.
You do not remember Werril?
Who is Werril?
Our home, our world.
That hurt. Falk said nothing.
Do you remember the journey here, Prech Ramaren?
The boy asked, stammering. There was incredulity in his voice. He seemed not to have taken in what Falk had told him. There was also a shaken, yearning note, checked by respect or fear. Falk shook his head. Ori repeated his question with a slight change.
You do remember our journey to Earth, Prech Ramaren?
No. When was the journey?
6 Terran years ago. Forgive me, please, Prech Ramaren. I did not know. I was over by the California Sea, and they sent an air car for me, an automatic. It did not say what I was wanted for. Then Lord Craggy told me one of the expedition had been found, and I thought, but he did not tell me this about your memory. You remember only the Earth, then?
He seemed to be pleading for a denial. I remember only the Earth, Falk said, determined not to be swayed by the boy's emotion, or his naivete, or the childish candor of his face and voice. He must assume that this Ori was not what he seemed to be. But if he was, I will not be fooled again, Falk thought bitterly. Yes, you will, another part of his mind retorted. You will be fooled if they want to fool you, and there is no way you can prevent it. If you ask no questions of this boy, lest the answer be a lie, then the lie prevails entirely, and nothing comes of all your journey here but silence and mockery and disgust. You came to learn your name. He gives you a name. Accept it. Will you tell me who we are? The boy eagerly began again in his gibberish, then checked himself at Falk's uncomprehending gaze.
You don't remember how to speak Kelshak, Prech Ramaren?
He was almost plaintive. Falk shook his head. Kelshak is your native language? The boy said,
yes,
adding timidly,
and yours, Prech Ramaren.
What is the word for father in Kelshak?
Hiowech, or Wawa for babies.
A flicker of an ingenuous grin passed over Ori's face. What would you call an old man whom you respected?
There are a lot of words like that. Kinship words. Prevwa, Kioinap, Skan Gehoi. Let me think. Prechna. I haven't spoken Kelshak for so long. A Prechnoeg, a higher-level non-relative, could be Teokioi or Previotio.
Teokioi. I said the word once, not knowing where I learned it. It was no real test. There was no test here. He had never told Estrell much about his stay with the old listener in the forest, but they might have learned every memory in his brain, everything he had ever said or done or thought while he was drugged in their hands this past night or nights. There was no knowing what they had done. There was no knowing what they could do or would. Least of all could he know what they wanted. All he could do was go ahead trying to get at what he wanted. Are you free to come and go here?
Oh, yes, Prech Ramaren. The lords have been very kind. They have long been seeking for any other survivors of the expedition. Do you know, Prechna, if any of the others?
I do not know.
All that Kradji had time to tell me when I got here a few minutes ago was that you had been living in the forest in the eastern part of this continent with some wild tribe.
I'll tell you that if you want to know. But tell me some things first. I do not know who I am, who you are, what the expedition was, what Werel is.
We are Kelshi,
the boy said with constraint, evidently embarrassed at explaining on so low a level to one he considered his superior, in age, of course, but also in more than age.
Of the Kelshak nation, on Werel. We came here on the ship Altera.
Why did we come here? Falk asked, leaning forward. And slowly, with digressions and backtrackings and 1,000 question interruptions, Ori went on, till he was worn out with talking and Falk with hearing, and the veil-like walls of the room were glowing with evening light. Then they were silent for a while, and dumb servants brought in food and drink for them. And all the time he ate and drank, Falk kept gazing in his mind at the jewel that might be false and might be priceless, the story, the pattern, the glimpse, true vision or not, of the world he had lost.